Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up. A new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me.
That's right, we got to change the world, you and me. We need some help, we need some help. So we're going to wake up everybody. Welcome to another episode of Missing Pages of History. And today, our theme is Welcome to the City of Baltimore and the Coronavirus. We can discuss a special, unique feature of what is happening to the City of Baltimore and how is that relevant to our various communities inside and outside of America, as well as what's going on with this issue dealing with this coronavirus. Those will be the features, issues of today's program. And like always, Missing Pages of History is a vehicle for the underserved communities. We'd like to welcome you again as the voice for MPH Radio. And the agenda will include the following. We will talk about this issue of giving you something to think about, followed by Black Mini Facts with Susie. And then we have a dialogue with Sister Tawena Jones, and we will have a perspective on what is happening in the city of Baltimore for the past several years, followed by a discussion with various political analysts who will give their analysis on the prison condition and the very unique condition of this issue of dealing with the coronavirus and the people that are lives. So that is our lineup. So right now, get you a pen and a piece of paper. What we're going to do right now, we just want to give you something to think about. Yes, give you something to think about. There are several quotes that we have chosen that we think applies to what's going on today. And one of the quotes came from Cornel West, Dr. Cornel West. He stated that you can't lead the people if you don't love the people. You can't save the people if you don't serve the people. What do y'all think about that? How does it apply to y'all daily reality? A second quote, which we found very interesting, was from one of the slave masters, Thomas Jefferson, who stated that, what country can preserve its liberties if its rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? Let them take arms. Uh-oh. Sounds like something we may have to deal with in the near future, very near future. He stated again, what country can preserve the liberties if its rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? Let them take arms. And the last quote of thought for the day, to give you something to think about, came from Albert Cummins. He said that the only way to deal with an unfree world is to become so absolutely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion. Let me read that one again. The only way to deal with an unfree world is to become so absolutely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion. I want you to take a few minutes to think about those particular quotes for the day. And we're going to pause for the call for a quick station break. And when we come back, Sister Susie for MPH is going to give you some MPH Black Mini Facts. And when we talk about the Black Mini Facts, we're going to speak to these Mini Facts in the context, again, what's relevant today, particularly as it relates to this issue of the coronavirus. So we're going to pause for this call, and we'll be right back, and you're going to listen to MPH Radio.
Tennessee.
Lord, I've really been real stressed, down and out, losing ground. Although I am black and brown, problems got me pessimistic. Brothers and sisters keep messing up. Why does it have to be so damn tough? I don't know where I can go to let these ghosts out of my skull. My grandma passed, my brother's gone. I never at once felt so alone. I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel, not just my spare tire. But Lord, I ask you to be my guiding force and truth. For some strange reason it had to be. He guided me to Tennessee.
A game of horseshoes.
Now I see the importance of history. While my people be in the mess today, be many journeys to freedom made in vain by brothers on the corner playing ghetto games. I ask you, Lord, why you enlighten me without the enlightenment of all my folks? said, cause I set myself on a quest for truth, and you was there to quench my thirst, but I am still thirsty. Lord, allow me to drink some more. He said, what I am searching for are the answers.
We'd like to welcome you back to MPH Radio, and we will continue this program after you bring in our sister Susan for MPH. She will share with you some black mini facts. Remember, we are a historical people. We are a people who make history. We are a people who is the foundation of humanity. So we're going to bring Sister Susie in. Sister Susie, give them the context, what's going on today, and looking at some of the contributions that African people have made. Will you share with our listening audience some MPH Black Mini Facts for today? The mic is yours, Susie.
Okay. Good evening. Our Black Mini Facts are coming from the Black Seeds calendar of 2020. Sick and tired of being sick and tired. Don't believe the hype. Lies. We are black geniuses. Historically, racism in medicine is a significant reason why our people have among the worst health care and health outcomes in America. Systematic racism has led to abuse and unethical experimentation. And for example, we have Henrietta Lacks' cancerous cells taken without her permission in 1951, used in research of polio vaccine, cloning, in vitro fertilization, gene mapping, etc. Another example is the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, which was held from 1932 to 1972. Dozens of black men died when deliberately infected and treatment withheld. Their wives, children, and others also became infected. J. Marlon Sims performed surgeries on enslaved women without using anesthesia. Cyril Bartman exhibited at carnivals and treated like an animal. Her skeleton, sexual organs, and brain were put on display. In the 1960s, doctors at Iona State Hospital diagnosed African Americans with schizophrenia because of their civil rights ideals. In 2015, the Center for Disease Control hid test results from black parents of an experimental measles vaccine that showed an increased likelihood of black children developing autism. So Everett Palmer Jr. died in police custody while on a trip in 2018. The 41-year-old veteran's body was returned home with no throat, heart, or brain, or an explanation. To prevent our victimization and defend our survival, we need to recognize and build upon the success of those who pursue careers in health and science. As such, we celebrate the outstanding achievements of Mae Jameson, Charles Drew, Daniel Hale William, Augustus Henson, and the following pioneers. The first pioneer is James McCoon Smith, 1837, first African-American man to earn a degree in medicine and to publish articles in a U.S. medical journal. Denied college admission in America, he moved to Scotland and earned his M.D. Our next pioneer is Myra Adair Logan, first woman to perform open-heart surgery in 1943, researched and studied antibiotics and breast cancer. Pioneer James Dume, first African-American physician in the U.S., born into slavery in 1762 and assisted doctors, established medical practice in New Orleans after he purchased his freedom. Although he lacked a medical degree, successfully treated patients during an outbreak of yellow fever in the 1780s. Pioneer Vivian Theodore Thomas, a former carpenter, trained as a surgical assistant, pioneered the Blue Baby surgery to correct a congenital heart defect known as teratorically of Fallot, and that was 1944. Pioneer Rebecca Lee Crumpler, first African-American woman physician in the U.S. She graduated in 1864 from medical school. Pioneer Emmett Chappelle holds 14 U.S. patents and inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame in 2007 for his work in bioluminescent science, supported manned spaceflight missions, and developed more accurately detect bacteria in water. Pioneer Alexa Kennedy, first African woman neurosurgeon in the U.S., and that was in 1981. Patricia Bath, MD, invented a new device and technique for cataract surgery known as laser phaco, the first woman to receive a medical patent in 1986. Pioneer Jane Wright, MD, developed a non-surgical method using a catheter system to deliver heavy doses of anti-cancer drugs to previously hard-to-reach tumor areas in the kidneys, the spleen, and elsewhere. And this was done in 1964. And our last pioneer is Mary E. Mahoney, first African-American woman to complete nurse's training. She graduated from the nursing school at the New England Hospital for Women and Children in 1879. And there you have some of our pioneers. And these are Black History Facts coming out of the Black Seas calendar 2020.
We'd like to thank you, Susie, for your contribution to highlighting some of the historical contributions that our people have made to humanity. And one of the things about history is that it's definitely is a tool that can best reward those who research. It's a tool that can show you what you have done, that can show you the potential of what you can do. And also it's a teaching tool to show you what has been done to you and who done it to you and what's the possibility of these things being inflicted upon you again if you are not organized and conscious of your past. So we'd like to thank you for those contributions. Sometimes just listening to you, it made me think of this whole issue of the more things change, the more they remain the same. So this is something you find a pattern when you go back and look at people's history. Right now, we're going to quickly pause for the calls. Then we'll go to our first major item or central focal theme for today's program. Here's this question. We can welcome you to the city of Baltimore. We can come back with Sister Tawana Jones, and she can give you a very unique perspective on the struggle and the history of the city of Baltimore and how we make and learn from their present-day struggles and movements. So you are listening to the voice of MPH, and we'll be right back. Thank you. like to welcome you back to MPH Radio. Oh, yeah, they got us living on the front line. Talking about living on the front line, we're going to feature one of our major features for today's program. It is the realities and the history of the struggle of the city of Baltimore. What's going on in the city of Baltimore? How can we use it to make a much more productive and positive future for our communities? And to help us do that, we have with our sister Tawana Jones. She's a resident of the city of Baltimore. She's an activist. She's an educator. She's basically one of the many of the million of people who love their people. And she's going to come with a very honest and unique perspective where she speaks truth to power to give us a better understanding for the past 3-4 years or so what is really happening in the city of Baltimore, particularly as it relates to the African population. So at this point in time, we'd like to bring Sister Tawana, and we'd like to welcome her to Missing Pages of History. Welcome, Sister Tawana.
Thank you for having me, brother. How are you?
Oh, we're doing great. We're doing great. We're having the opportunity to speak to our people and to share information so we can advance the forward progress for all of humanity. And we're happy to have you to be a part of this particular program today because, Sister Tawana, we have had a chance to hear you from around the world, speaking on various platforms, and the kind of information and knowledge that you bring to our community is definitely needed. So what we want to do is get directly to the real issue of what is happening with the city of Baltimore from your perspective for the past several years. So we'll leave it open for you to just give us your general synopsis of what's going on in the city of Baltimore, Sister Tawana.
Basically, you know, I love my city, but I'm real disappointed at my city right now. And I've been disappointed for the last 7 years because before we had the Freddie Gray uprise, my family supporters, we've been out there advocating now going on 7 years, literally 346 weeks nonstop continuation of fighting and advocating for police brutality because I knew from day one when my brother was killed on the grounds here by people that's supposed to serve and protect that ultimately took his life, 11 to 15 Baltimore City officers as well as one Morgan State University officer, but nevertheless, nobody would hear the cries and things of that nature. It wasn't until, and we were trying to, you know, make sure what had happened in Ferguson didn't happen here in Baltimore. That's why we kept staying on the grounds because even before Michael Brown, my brother, blood laid on the ground, before Eric Gardner, my brother, blood laid on the ground. And my heart goes out to Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, as well as Freddie Gray. But nevertheless, when it hit Baltimore as far as the uprise, when things start burning down and the nation started watching, I noticed that everything went up as I thought it would, meaning that when the consent decree came here to monitor us and things of that nature, that basically the Baltimore City police officers basically turned their back on us. And it's all a part of the scam, like to basically kind of, it's like mind control, basically, because back then when Freddie Gray was murdered, ultimately murdered and whatnot, you know, the homicide rate was kind of down, you know. But immediately after everybody pulled together for one cause, one fight, one purpose type of thing, everybody, I'm talking about different religions, I'm talking about Bloods and Crips, I'm talking about everybody, and they couldn't stand it. So what they did was turn their back on us, and then the murder rate here is ridiculously high. And more so, I think it's not even all just community violence. My theory on it is, you know, they keep having these, like, shooters that are, like, taking perfect aim, killing our young folks. I'm not saying every murder that happens in the city. I'd be crazy if I say, oh, every murder, oh, it's somebody, you know, that's trying to kill our people. That's not what I'm saying. But my suspicions is up very high because we keep on having unknown shooters and things like that. And for Baltimore, basically to have two mass shootings in less than a couple months and nobody, like the world's not reporting on it, is ridiculous. Like we had a shooting at a hookah lounge. A white guy got out and was walking down downtown Baltimore. We know anybody that comes to Baltimore know in certain streets, especially where they got like nightclubs, they have cameras watching. I'm not even just talking about the cameras that take pictures of your tag to give you those little speed tickets to make the city rich off of us. But anyway, I'm talking about cameras that's on top of businesses. But ironically, it was a white guy walking down the street with an automatic weapon, and he shot like 7 people up. It was like teenagers in a line standing waiting to get inside of a hookah lounge. They were all like shot up. Thank God nobody died. But they never caught the shooter. And just last week on, to be exact, on last Thursday, we just had in West Baltimore, the police said they basically pulled up on the scene of someone shooting an automatic weapon. He shot 7 people, he or she, I don't know, they never told us if it's a man, if it's a woman, if the suspect, they're not describing how the suspect looks or anything, which really raises a red flag where 7 people actually got hit, and it's just right, the media just wiped it right away, and all they kept saying was, oh, well, the officer wasn't hurt, and meanwhile, we have an active shooter, and meanwhile, I bring that awareness up because it's ironic that a police could pull up or somebody shooting at black folks in a black community, right? And you don't take aim or anything, but yet my brother was driving. My Mercedes been an unarmed man, no weapon, pulled out by his dreadlocks, beat, pepper spray, tased, a horrific beating. And, you know, that's okay. It's not okay. You get what I'm saying? So we need to wake up. And I keep telling people everything the media is very dangerous. They have the power to make innocent people look guilty and guilty people look innocent. So whatever they basically want to feed your mind and want you to concentrate on, that is what they do. We had a bunch of black young girls going missing by the minute here in Baltimore City. I ain't talking about around, I'm talking about in my city. We know that it's happening around the world. We know that over 75,000 missing black women, young, old, well, you know, just black women in general, they're missing and nobody's talking about this. Not worldwide news and nobody's solving none of this. And they don't want to solve this legalized genocide. You know what I mean? And my red flag went up because the news was actually, instead of them talking about it, they would actually write it across the bottom of the screen. And I'm like, are you kidding? When the police will kill somebody, instead of them talking about it, they badly talk about certain things. But normally when stuff like this happens, to kind of block your mind, they will write stuff across the screen. But then meanwhile telling you how Donald Trump is doing this and Trump is doing that. Foolishness. So, yeah, and I basically have been working now for the last past 7 years because in my brother's case, they offered me and my family $1 million and whatnot settlement for the wrongful death of my brother. We know he was murdered because at the end of the day, they wouldn't give you a dime if they knew that they didn't do something wrong. And the crazy part with me knowing that there's no statutation limit on murder, I'm going to always go after these killers. Like, they can solve cases 40, 50 years later. I don't care if I'm in my 50s, late, whatever age that I become, and keep on fighting until I get accountability. I'm never going to stop because this is bigger than my brother. And that's why I started something called West Wednesday in Baltimore, where we actively are out in the street in every community talking about this police brutality and not just my brother case. Because, see, the way the system works is dirty. That's like a virus. It wants you to believe one thing is very misleading, and it wants you to believe that these are isolated incidents when, in fact, they're systemically happening, and it's happening all over the world. So what I did was when I noticed with my brother's case, the similarities to all my brothers and sisters' case, I'd have been around the world. Unfortunately, I wouldn't want to wish anyone into this family, but meeting Alton Sterling's family, meeting Michael Brown's family, meeting all the high profile cases, and even the ones that we don't know about, it is real. The pain is real. The devastation is real. It's just a different victim name, but the same story. No justice, no peace, and that just needs to stop. It just needs to stop. But until we change these white racist laws, nothing's going to change. And the way they did things in my city was they would offer you hush money, basically in order for you to get your suitcase money, your wrongful death suitcase money. You would have to actually, you know, turn the cheek, shut your mouth, and keep it moving, and let these killer cops keep on get away with bloody murder, slaughtering our brothers and sisters. You know what I mean? So I was like, you're not going to do that. No, no thank you. You know what I mean? So I took my name off, because had I would have said anything, it would have jeopardized my brothers' children's monies and whatnot. And at the end of the day, God forbid, if anything happens to me and this city is responsible for it, they better take care of my children, because I'm no longer here. So, but what I did was started working and reaching out with different coalitions, and also with the ACLU here in Baltimore City, and us all together. You know, we got with politicians in our city. We also, like, with Jews for Justice, Runners for Justice, the West Coalition, Not Without Black Women. We all got together, and we actually got the city president, councilman, to actually sponsor a bill, basically, that as of the beginning of this year, you're able to now get your settlements, right? And you can actually talk about it. And we were asking them in our piece of legislation to actually go back and where so everybody can talk about it. So we didn't want just the new cases. We wanted everybody. So right now, you know, we got this bill in place, but yet how these politicians were, you know, our mayor basically said, you know, that the city council people don't have the right to tell him what to do, so he's not going to follow the law. So we're still trying to work those details out. But the least the fact that I know that this piece of legislation is wrote down in place, because he thought it was going to be hell's end when he met with me and my coalition folks and said, well, you know what, I'll do an executive order. And we're like, no, at the end of the day, an executive order changed with folks. Like, you know, election time is coming up soon. You're, you know, if you're out there, that executive order leaves with you. We need something cast in stone, you know. So he didn't even sign our bill, even though he didn't go again. He didn't oppose it, but he didn't sign it. But it actually went into legislation without his signature, which, hey, it is what it is. But at the end of the day, we just got to keep fighting, and we got to realize that all these things are together, not just like how they always try to talk about, you know, black-on-black crime. That's just another way to get in our mind and say, you know what, until y'all stop killing each other, we're not, y'all life don't matter, we're not going to protect y'all. And I'm coming back saying that, you know, I've never heard of such idiocy in my life for them to say black-on-black crime. Caucasian kill Caucasians. That's not Caucasian or Caucasian crime. Asians kill Asians. That's not Asian or Asian crime. So my point is saying all this, you're not going to put us in a box. So I call it community violence. Any race of people can kill each other, but why do they always highlight when, oh, black people, you know, are killing each other, and, or they always try to highlight, oh, well, the father wasn't in the home, when we got a broken system, not even broke, a failed system, because it's doing what it's exactly designed to do, and that's wipe us out. You get what I'm saying? It's not designed to protect our black skin. It's not designed for that. It's, in fact, designed to just wipe us out and let us bow down to modern-day slavery, and I refuse to. And they'll talk about, oh, well, we got all these deadbeat fathers that are not there. Well, meanwhile, they set up the welfare program, and the word welfare backwards is farewell. You're saying farewell to the black man in the home. You're making these sister queens take them down and put them in a system that's already want their blood, and then now they can't get their licenses, they can't get a job, but yet they call it a family investment. They're supposed to be investing in the family, but yet the man can't be in the home. The family can't be together. What kind of investment is that? Yeah, it's an investment of disaster is what I call it. So I'm just going to keep fighting all these issues and letting everybody know that we need to all fight together, even though I advocate for police brutality, but I advocate for all the issues, because guess what? I always say, even if you take a different street to get down to one main highway, we're going to all end up on that road, the road of death where they're killing us. So whatever street you decide, if you decide to take St. Paul Street, Charles Street, Howard or Cathedral Street, it's going to all run you into that highway of hell. And as long as I know that we're rolling that way, we need to roll together and fight this thing. One case, one cause, one purpose. So that's what's happening in Baltimore.
You know, Sister Toronto, many people believe Baltimore is problematic of many cities throughout this country. Today, when you talk about this whole question of accountability and the question of dependability when it comes to your elected leadership, and more particularly when you come to your African elected leadership, how would you assess that relationship between the African leadership and political leaders and their desire and interest in terms of representing and meeting the needs and interests of that particular community? What has been your experiences in Baltimore in terms of things may have gone down the last couple of years?
To me, in my opinion, brother, to me, like one of my brothers always say, he say all black ain't black. You know, he talks about Negro pains and things of that nature. But nevertheless, what is happening is they put these different black folks in there that are not pushing the black agenda, that's basically just a black face in office. And they're like, and the first thing when you go down to fight these crazy laws, when I go down to testify in Annapolis, I had them sitting in my face talking about, oh, y'all got a black mayor, y'all got a black state attorney, blah, blah, like that, like that's making a difference. Like, it's just ridiculous. So to me, I just feel like until we get real leadership, we're going to have, and not corruption, because that's all you see in Baltimore. Right now, our city controller is being investigated for billions of dollars right now. We just really, like our mayor, Mayor Catherine Pugh, she just went to jail for her Healthy Hollybook scandals and things of that nature. But the crazy part is that, you know, when the black people do what the white man has been doing for decades, they make an example out of the black folks, not saying, oh, well, you get up there, be corrupt, go with the flow. No, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying at the end of the day, you know, once you learn the connection, it deals with the complexion. And they've been basically, all that stuff is just so corrupt and so contaminated. You know, they get in there thinking they can do the same thing as the man, and then they get dragged underneath for the mud and dragged, and then you get the white woman doing the same exact thing, or the white man doing the same exact thing, and then it's a laugh and it's a joke. But I'm just over, like, is there so much of corruption? To me, they really need to clean house completely, knock it down, build it back up, start all over again, because as another one of my brothers said, you cannot clean a filthy house with a dirty mop. What is going to happen is you're spreading dirt from one end to the other. So to me, with the black politicians that have been representing in my city right now has failed us terribly. And I'm not saying that one black face or one person could come in and fix up a mess. That's not what I'm saying. But if you in there, please explain to me how we going on for years. Children can't even go to school in the wintertime because they don't even have the proper heat. You get what I'm saying? But just so when we talk about or we hear about what's going on now with this coronavirus, it's showing me what I've been through all the time, that if this system wanted to work for us and work with us, it could, but it's designed to work against us. Like now, they're freezing people. They're not putting people out for that like are going to experience in the next 30 to 90 days, I believe, are not going to be able to pay their mortgage because of what's going on. We can't go on the street. But what about when they take black folks' houses just because of a daggone water bill? You get what I'm saying? You do that now, but now you can, oh, we're going to waive this and we're going to waive that. It's ridiculous. So we know that you could have did it, but you didn't do it. You didn't do it because it's a capitalist system. So the capitalist system is a way to bring us all down. It's just ridiculous. But now, like I said, with the coronavirus.
Can I stop you for a second? Make sure I heard you correctly. Are you telling me people have lost their actual homes because they could not meet a water bill payment? How could that be?
I done had people come to West Lansby, black folks, that says, you know what, this is crazy. Me and my wife had our house over 50, 60 years, but because we couldn't pay our water bill, they snatched it. I done got threats from the water bill about my daggone house because I'm a homeowner, saying, oh, well, if you don't take care of your declined bill, we can, like, it's real. Like I said, so you can get, you can actually snatch somebody's house about a water bill. You get what I'm saying? But now when, you know, America wants to work with us, oh, don't touch the folks. Give them 90 days or more to get up their rent or their mortgage payment. Don't snatch their car. So just let me know. This, like, coronavirus had woke and let me know, like, just open my eyes a little bit more to let me know everything that I thought that they could do is manifesting. And then even now in the city of Baltimore, we have the old mayor, like I said, that's facing jail time. So they use these black people to go after our black people, not to help them, but to go actually go after our black people. Like, she had started, like, saying something about the Squeegee Boys. She was saying, like, she tried to invite them to do something with her, and they declined because they're like, we don't want to work for the Baltimore Police Department. We want to, the Squeegee Boys been around for, I know, since before I was born. Type of thing. I remember they used to wipe my mother's car off and my father's car type of thing when we were driving down the street. But now all of a sudden the Squeegee kids, they're using this narrative, oh, the Squeegee Boys are dangerous and they doing this and they busting windows and they doing that. But they can always say, you know, they'll look at everybody and they'll throw everything around because of one or two. But yet they'll say, we hear this all the time, it's only one or two bad apples on a police force. No, I feel sorry for the very few good cops or good men and women that they have in blue. I feel sorry for them because there's many, many that abuse their powers, that abuse people, and it's not right.
You know, Teron, one of the things we want to learn from the people who live in the city of Baltimore, your experiences is, because we believe that looking at what's going on today around this coronavirus and how the state is operating, many people believe that at some point in time, the whole country will be under a state of emergency where they bring in brute military force, the military, National Guard, et cetera, to control and, you know, and interact with the people. What can you tell us from your experiences in Baltimore, the impact that it has had on the people in Baltimore when they brought in National Guard and, from my understanding, the military the last year or so in terms of trying to stop this so-called riot among the people in Baltimore? What can you tell us, for just in general, from that particular experience? What was that lacking? What kind of impact is it having on the people?
So just in general, of knowing that if we have police officers that abuse their police powers, that their badge makes them above the law. So we have them abusing us. And in the time when we're in the uprise and whatnot, and they brought the National Guards here and things of that nature, had it not been, and I can gladly say this now, because even though I went up against our commissioner at the time, his name was Commissioner Betts, but had it not for him making good judgment and saying to tell the police to hold back, to tell the National Guard to hold back, so many of our brothers and sisters during the uprising would have been slaughtered in the street. But he probably said, you know what, when I walked in day one, I had blood on my hand. He had to deal with the police victim named Anthony Anderson, in which he had took the family, the autopsy, hand-delivered. He took it to their house, and it was ruled a homicide, but yet they did nothing about these repeat violent offenders that killed Anthony Anderson in 2012. But I said all this to say that, so back to your question, with them now enforcing, you know, the National Guard to come over here to help quarantine people and things like that, I'm just praying that it don't get out of control, because to me, I feel like everything right now, including this virus, is population control. population control at its fullest. And I just don't want anyone to get hurt. And, you know, it's just crazy. So that's just my thoughts. And we know that things at any second, at a split second, can literally go haywire. You can go from, oh, we told you get back in your home, don't step out, to we blowing your brains off and blowing your brains out, I'm sorry. And now we're justified because we're under this, you know, whatever. So it's just crazy. And I don't think it's a good thing. I really don't. I think what, you know, is happening as far as, like, trying to, like, quarantine folks and different things, yeah, that's cool. But at the end of the day, the way, even the way they're doing, they don't even have enough tests. I don't know what's going on in your city, but as for Baltimore, I know the numbers are way higher than what they're reporting, but at the end of the day, you're not seeing anybody's faces of who are the actual, you know, people that are getting sick or affected by the coronavirus. All we keep getting is different numbers. We went literally from last Monday, 32 people that tested positive, all the way yesterday, and I know the numbers are spiked because every day it just spikes up completely, but I said all that to say it went up to, yes, as of yesterday's report, it went to 149 folks, but I said all that to say a lot of folks have been, like this one guy, he has asthma and everything, he went to the hospital, he wanted to test, he has all the symptoms of coronavirus, but yet they wouldn't test him. The reason they wouldn't test him, they don't have tests, they're still waiting for tests to come in. So meanwhile, you got hundreds and hundreds of folks that are experiencing, you know, the symptoms, all that, but yet they're being turned away from hospitals. They can't be tested. All they're being told at this moment, go in the house, quarantine yourself from, you know, for 10 to 14 days type of thing. So it's crazy. It's just population control to me. And then to share it, I'm going to share it on our sister Dr. Empress Chi program tonight. But I saw a black brother, African man, bless his heart, that, you know, and he was real deep. And it's a video that he's actually sharing, but it's, you can't share it, like, directly on Facebook. You can only share it on the inbox. But what he told me was so deep, brother, it changed my life. He basically said with this coronavirus, even though they don't have what he said, they don't have anything right now for it, a vaccine. He said, but there is a cure. They don't want to talk about the cure because, like, I heard a sister queen on your show not too long ago that was talking about how the medical field does all this crazy stuff and how they used our sister and they test her and all that at Hopkins. That's why we was actually here trying to shut Hopkins down, you know, using us as guinea pigs and things of that nature. But this black brother said, even though there is not a virus, even though the virus is here and there's not a vaccine, listen to the way they treat, it's not a vaccine, but it's definitely a cure. And this cure was simple. And let me tell you what this brother said and shared. He said, now, in order for you to get the coronavirus, is basically, you know, what happens is it goes inside of your nostrils, right? And it lives in that cool space in your nose. That's where it hits you. And he said right now they were saying, like, oh, you got to touch something. Like, no, he said basically you basically just can be in the air. It's airborne. So basically if I got the coronavirus and I'm just talking to you, I ain't got no spit, I ain't cough or nothing, if you in that same space with me and we're just having a conversation, we could be 6 or 10 feet apart, you're going to actually contract it. What happens is the virus goes up into your nostril. That's where it lives at until it grows these bacteria and whatnot. And what happens, and that's why a lot of people don't get any type of symptoms until 10 days later, because meanwhile it's growing into your nostrils, and then it spreads down into your throat area, and that's why you get that real bad sore throat type of thing. And then what happens after that, because don't nobody know how to cure it and things like that, now it's going into your lungs. And then anybody that's having, like, underlying heart issues, things of that nature, is flooding out your lungs. So if your lungs are not strong enough, it's like you're drowning in your lungs, right? Then you could die. That's why you're having a fatality. But what this brother shared with me was so sweet and simple. He said the same way you inhale to actually get the virus, he had a therapy, aromatherapy. He said what you do, he said get a big pot of water, He said, take the orange. He had his son on there. He had both his sons helping them and showing us in the video. They peeled the orange peel. They took the orange peel and cut them up into maybe 5 pieces. He put some sea salt in the pot. Or if you don't have an orange peel, he said, what works is basically the virus cannot stand heat. And that's what they're trying to do with this cure. They're going to be over the next 6 to 18 months trying to find something hot, because the only thing that can kill this virus is heat. So what he did was say, you either chop you up an onion, let that thing boil, put some sea salt on there, or use the orange peeling, because there was something in that orange peeling that had some type of special vitamin or something. That's why he chose the orange peeling. But last night, I did the thing on myself. Only thing I had in my house, because I had just got over the flu like 3 weeks ago, and I'm thinking in my mind, I kept telling everybody, the way Baltimore was hit with that flu, where I'm talking about at my school, I'm a teacher, educator, 90% of the staff, so-called, quote-unquote, had the flu. And the same way they test that coronavirus, they put that thing in those, the same way they diagnosed me. And immediately, when I got whatever I had, the so-called, quote-unquote, flu, I could not stop coughing. My throat felt like somebody was choking me out. Oh, my God, my lungs were on fire. I felt like I was going to die. You get what I'm saying? So, and then it took my voice away. And it was just crazy. But long story short, like every night I kept coughing and coughing, even though it's been weeks. I've been like over the so-called quote-unquote flu. They gave me the Tamiflu, all this foolishness. I've been over it or whatever, but I keep at night having a chronic cough. My voice never came completely back. So I said, let me try this little aromatherapy to see if this thing works. Sure enough, all I had was some garlic salt, and I had the sea salt. I put that thing in a pot. I let it boil for like maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and I actually stood over my pot like the brother instructed me. He said, please, if you can stand 15 minutes there, he said, it will kill whatever. And he said, it kills the flu. It kills all type. Man, when I said I felt like a new person, I even looked at myself in the mirror. My skin looked about. I said, oh, my God. Like, really? So that's what I want to share. Like, that was real and deep. And I feel like anybody that feel like they got any cold symptoms, or you go out here and you like, I'm going to go travel to the store real quick when I end this call. But when I come back in, sure enough, again, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go get me my pie. I'm going to go get my orange peel. I got my sea salt. And I'm going to make that little a therapy room and stuff. And I'm going to inhale, breathe all in and suck that up. And when I say you feel like a brand new person, you feel like a straight brand any person. So, yeah, it's real.
And Sister Tawana, on that note, we'd like for you to maybe share with our listening audience, people would like to stay in touch and find out more what's going on and how they can help you in your movement. How can they contact you?
So they can actually contact me. I'm going to give everybody my email address. My email address is Miss, M-I-S-S, T-A-W-A-N-D-A, that's Miss Tawanda, the number 17, at yahoo.com. They can send me an email, and from there I will send them my personal direct cell phone number. We can contact. They can also inbox me on Facebook. I'm on Facebook. I have 2 pages. One is my brother page. One is Justice for Tyrone West. They can inbox me there, send me a message out. Gladly return it, and then they also can reach me on my personal page. It says my personal page is Tawanda Jones. That's TawandaJones, and on my profile picture, I survived, but people don't know my story or something like that. It's a picture of me. So, yeah, they can send me an inbox and all, because I got, I think, 5,000 friends. But if they send me an inbox, they can reach me through Facebook, and I'll definitely return all messages. Yeah, and then I want to share with you quickly. I don't know if you ever got a chance to meet the sister, Erica Gordon. She was Emmett Till's cousin. She was a frontline fighter. I just heard the sister queen died this morning, and she was in the hospital since the 12th of this month, and she had actually made it out of ICU, and we solicited the prayers. I remember a couple days ago, maybe 5 to 6 days ago, I sent her a message like, Sister Queen, I'm praying for you, and she's like, I'm fine, and, you know, I'm doing much better. Thank you, sister, you know, that type of thing. And for me to actually get up this morning, jump on Facebook, because I always want to see the upcoming, you know, reports of this coronavirus and just things of that nature, for me to see that we lost the queen, it was devastating. Like, she always put out about her cousin, great cousin, Edmund Till, and she kept his name alive, and then she was a beautiful queen, man. So I say to our sister queen.
Shay, on that note, Sister Juana, we'd like to thank you for making your contribution to today's program as it relates to getting us a better understanding of the city of Baltimore and what is going on. We thank you for filling that aspect of one of the many missing pages of our history. We thank you again, Sister Juana.
And thank you, brother, for having your show and always putting out information and doing the work that you do, because it, had it not been for forums like your platform and things like that that are forming people and, you know, and just being all the way black, having a black agenda, I just want to thank you. I just want to thank everybody that came on your show, the folks that are on now, that are waiting in queue, and just thank your listening audience. I just want to thank you guys. Yep.
All right, on that note, you're listening to the voice of MPH. What we're going to do right now, we're going to pause for the calls, but when we come back, we'll somewhat continue the discussion, but this discussion will solely be around this whole issue of the coronavirus. We invited some political analysts and panelists from around various states who have been following this issue very closely, and there are some things that you need to be aware of, and they're going to tweak our interest in terms of what we need to be aware of and what are some of the possibilities as relates to this whole pandemic, as relates to the coronavirus. We're going to discuss that and more and fill in our missing pages when we come right back from the station break. We're going to pause for the calls. We'll be right back. like to welcome back to MPH Radio. Right now, we would like to go to our second major item on this agenda for today's program. Is we want to talk just a little bit about the coronavirus and what is happening in our various communities around the world. And one of the things Mr. Page of History seeks to do is to be a platform of discovering information that's very vital to the well-being of our underserved communities. I would hope for the next few minutes to do this by raising some thought-provoking around the issue of some of the possibilities of what we may have to deal with and are dealing with. And in do that, we have invited some political analysts and panelists from various shows from different parts of the region to talk about the coronavirus and pandemic and give us some things to think about so we can critically take a look at this issue and make decisions that will be in the best interest and well-being of our communities and humanity. The views that you hear are views that will be totally expressed and will be represent that particular individual. But we felt that it was important to hear the views, which has often been and always, for the most time, they are left outside of mainstream media. So given that backdrop, we're going to talk about this coronavirus pandemic, and we invited several analysts and panelists to come. We first would like to first bring them in. We first would like to welcome Mr. Anthony Nguyen out of the state of New Jersey. We'd like to welcome him to Missing Pages of History. Welcome, Anthony.
Thanks for having me, brother. I was listening very carefully to what the sister was saying about the situation in Baltimore. And it's fairly similar to the situation going on in cities like Newark and New York City. Thing is that it might be worse to some degrees than others because of geographical and demographic differences, but it's the same issue. And the thing is, there is throughout the U.S. there are inadequate tests available to get a handle on how this pandemic is spreading. So health officials don't have a handle on just how widespread it actually is. And people that have underlying health conditions are especially the most vulnerable. And because of the poor quality of health care in our communities generally, there are a lot of people that have underlying health issues such as diabetes, high blood pressure, et cetera. And also there's a substantial portion of our population that's incarcerated, and being in crowded spaces are breeding grounds for the spreading of various diseases. So our situation is very dire, and we must get better organized than we are if we are to overcome this crisis.
We next would like to bring in panelist analyst Haki Kamafi out of the state of Virginia. We'd like to welcome you, brother Haki, to MPH. Just a brief overview on this question of the coronavirus and the pandemic. What you make of it?
Let me start by saying this is a political world, and one of the things very interesting, the research has came about as it relates to coronavirus is this. One of the things, you know, in the past we talked a lot about in terms of the evolution of viruses, you know, political weaponry being utilized, you know, by states like the U.S., specifically for the sole purpose of eliminating a large number of people throughout the world. Now, we talk about people like Raymond Zelensky, and we talk about people like Walter Basun, So we talk about the evolution of things like AIDS, virus, Ebola, and so forth and so on, and understand that these things are made in laboratories. Now, having said that, we have to understand that in terms of coronavirus, and the scientists are very clear on this point, in order for the coronavirus to exist, first and foremost, it has to have those viruses as a stepping stone from which to build. So this notion that this virus is somehow independently created or somehow evolved from nothing is disingenuous. In fact, it's very much part in terms of the growing trend in terms of bioweaponry being utilized by Western states for the purpose of depopulation. So it's important that we understand that reality. In understanding that reality, we understand that if there's a fixation among the Western leaders in terms of eliminating large number of people, then it seems to me that organization is your best bet in terms of fighting against, you know, these designs. If we don't organize in terms of fighting against these designs, then we succumb to these designs. And that's precisely what they want. They want us weak, debilitated. They want a position of vulnerability. They, along with reducing a large number of people, they also want to make sure you have a situation where conceivably where it's so easy in terms of actually rounding up a large number of people, you know, very, very easily. So we got our work cut out for us in terms of what's going on in society, but I think first and foremost, people have to understand that this is part of politics. This has nothing to do in terms of viruses developing independently, but it has everything more to do with political design. And if we don't understand reality, then there's no way conceivable in the future we can put an end to this kind of insanity.
Thank you, Brother Hackey, for your opening statement. And we now will go with Brother Maurice Robson. I also, out of the state of Virginia, welcome to MPH. Your general, what was your thought on this question or on this issue of the coronavirus pandemic? Brother Maurice.
Hey, peace, brothers, peace. Thank you for having me here today. I just want to first send my condolences to Sister Tawanda and her family on the assassination of her brother. But the situation with the coronavirus, like Brother Hackey stated, you can't say it no better. It is a political agenda underlying this issue, and it's a lot of in 1 week a lot of interesting news came out. A lot of interesting news with the rise of hate groups, of white supremacist groups is on the rise, and on the same hand, you got the rise of gun sales going up. You know, people are in a frenzy, or people are getting armed with guns of that sort. But I would urge specifically African people to become political armed. That's where we at right now. Like Sister Tawanda's presentation, she in one of her points of the presentation, she targeted the main root of all of the issues, capitalism. As we all know, capitalism birthed racism, if you will. If you understand history and understand politics and understand our oppression, you would see that all of these things are related, which were created during our enslavement of our ancestors of Africans. So that's where we at right now, man. I would urge all listeners to become politically armed, not only armed with guns or weapons, but also politically armed.
Okay, thank you, Brother Maurice. All right, panelists, what I want to do right now, I would like each one of y'all to respond to this particular article that was published a couple of days ago. It was on the 16th of March. And it's a very interesting article because often when we talk about the truth, we know the truth can come out in different forms. Sometimes it can objectively, just come out as, this is what happened. Sometimes you use jokes to tell truth. Sometimes we create fictitious narratives to disguise the truth. But if you look at the essence of it, it deals with the truth. Now, Mr. Page of History, Discover, and Rain Across, if you're interested in the article, we'd like to share with our listening audience. And we'd like to encourage all our listening audience to Google and read this article. And panelists, I can read a few things from this article. And once you put it in context of what's going on today, what do y'all make of it? This article is titled, and Google this article, is titled, Before Trump's Inauguration, A Warning, The Worst Influenza Pandemic Since 1918. And these are some of the subtext writings in the article. It states that in a tabletop exercise days before a untested new president took power, official brief the incoming administration on a scenario remarkably like the one he faces now. Now, it says that President Donald Trump delivered the inauguration address in January 2017. Now, it says that seven days before Donald Trump took office, his aides faced a major test, the rapid global spread of dangerous viruses in cities like London and Seoul, one serious enough that some countries were imposing travel bans. In a sober briefing, Trump's incoming team learned that the disease was an emerging pandemic, a strain of novel influenza known as H9N2, and the health system was crushing in Asia, and all overwhelmed by the demand. Health officials warned that this could become the worst influenza pandemic since 1918. Trump aides were told soon they hear crises. Now listen to this. They hear crises were popping up in California and Texas. The briefing was intended to hammer home a new terrifying reality facing the Trump administration and the incoming president's responsibility to protect Americans in a crisis. But unlike the coronavirus pandemic currently raging the globe, in 2017 crisis didn't really happen. It was among a handful of situations presented to Trump top aides as a part of a legal required transition exercise with members of the outgoing administration of Barack Obama. And in the words of the several attendees, the atmosphere was weird at best, chilly at worst. So, in other words, they said there was actually a meeting of creating scenarios of these possibilities to the Trump administration at the beginning of its transition from the Obama administration that they possibly may need to be prepared for such a pandemic in which we are facing now. And everything sounds so identical. What do y'all make of that, panelists? Of that reality that took place, and the president administration didn't take it seriously to be able to even consider of that as a possibility. What can we draw from that, Anthony?
Yeah, we can draw from that this was something that was planned for a while. And the masses of the people were kept in the dark about it. And, the society wasn't prepared to deal with it as it is presently. It's notable that throughout, the current administration, as well as the previous administration since then of World War II, military spending has skyrocketed. But support for public health, things that matter to the welfare of the people have been cut. And, you know, so I think that's, you know, that's very telling. And this type of society places a priority over the preservation of things rather than people's lives. And that's a characteristic feature of capitalism.
Haki, what's your analysis of that situation?
Yeah. I think the thing we have to realize is that, you know, a lot of times when these plans are made in secret, there are people who are privy to these plans who don't necessarily agree with these plans, and often they advise, you know, genius ways in terms of leaking information. Now, for instance, most people don't know, but Dean Koontz wrote a book called The Eyes of Darkness, in which he talked about the coronavirus. They even referred to the name of the virus in the book as Wuhan 400. Isn't that interesting? Very, very interesting. Now, keep in mind also, there was recently, 2 months prior to the release of this information, well, 2 weeks prior to release of the coronavirus information, there was a large conference called Event 21 in which they actually discussed this virus. So clearly people had a firm understanding in terms of what had transpired and what was going to transpire in terms of coronavirus. So this notion that people are ignorant in terms of, you know, is evolution is so disingenuous. So again, it speaks to political planning. And now this is why it's so important that when we talk about organization, we have to understand that these people are very, very organized. And so when they plan things, they do it in advance. And so they know exactly how they're going to move. And one of the reasons why Trump is resistant in terms of, you know, providing, you know, respirators, masks for the people, is because he wants the virus to give it time to do his job. In other words, he wants to kill more and more people. And so, therefore, there is no urgency in terms of providing people with the kind of testing they need in terms of preventing spread of disease. And so when you're talking about 500,000 people losing their lives in America, then clearly we shouldn't be deluding ourselves into believing that this 500,000 people who will die is not desirable by those positions of power. And lastly, Brother Africa, this is also important. When we talk about the evolution of coronavirus, one of the things we know we often blame China as the epicenter. But reality is that, you know, months before the so-called rise of coronavirus in China, there was actually six cases that the authorities knew about in the United States. There were three cases in the UK, in the United Kingdom, in terms of coronavirus, and there was two in Canada. So clearly, this virus had to start long before it reached reached China. So this notion that China is the epicenter is disingenuous. But again, when we talk about political strategy, one of the things they want to do is a misdirection. And so while we're looking at China in terms of the epicenter in terms of coronavirus, we fail to understand that the history is very, very clear that the United States has always been in the forefront in terms of biological weaponry, in terms of its desire to eliminate a large number of people from the planet. And so when we have situations like when we talk about population control, we talk about people like Bill Gates, and talk about people like Henry Kissinger, and people like Brzezinski, Brzezinski. When we talk about people like that who are very powerful people in the government who express a willing desire in terms of population control, in terms of killing millions and millions and millions of people throughout the world, we should take this very, very seriously, understanding that this is all part of political strategy, and nobody should defeat themselves or anything less.
And Brother Maurice, your response to this article.
In 1963, Kwame Nkrumah stated a new and vigorous approach to the problem of peace and war is needed. The time has come with the destiny of mankind to cease to hang so dangerously on the aims and ambitions of the great powers. And the powers he was referring to is the between the East and West. It's time for Africa to rise. That's my response, because and I would say this, a lot of attention is not being given on the hard work of Cuba off of progressive political countries. Cuba took in a British cruise ship who had people on the ship who had the illness, had the COVID-19 illness, and they was turned away from other countries, but Cuba took them in. And it's kind of funny that if America is so is so humanistic as they claim to be. They got best interests of every country at heart. Why is they not taking off the sanctions off of Cuba, off of Iran and Venezuela? There was an article that came out that the sanctions, more people could have been living in Iran if the sanctions wasn't put on by America. An economist came out on Thursday and put out an article. A group of economists and policy experts, they said President Donald Trump should immediately lift the United States' crippling sanctions against Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba and other countries, warning that the economic warfare, in addition to being cruel in itself, is feeding the coronavirus epidemic by hampering nations' capacity to respond. That being said, if they so humanistic, why, you know, they should be removing these sanctions off these countries who are suffering. Well, not really, you know, who are suffering from the virus. And also along that, you got a lot of countries around the world who are now relying on Cuba medical power to help them to prevent further illnesses of the coronavirus. You got President Bolsonaro in Brazil, a far-right president who is relying on and crying for Cuba's help. So it's kind of funny that you got all of this going on among the nations who are against Cuba, who are against Venezuela and Iran, but they still want to further oppress while also using their intelligence and their medical power. So that's funny. And the last point I want to concur with is Africa. There's a lot of mixed reports about Africa dealing with the coronavirus. Egypt has reported nearly 200 cases and 6 deaths. South Africa is the continent's first country who had cases double to 116 from 2 days before. And Somalia announced its first cases this week. Uganda has no cases. But they also said that 34 35 countries out of 54 nations in Africa have cases. So it's just different reports, but we gotta stay organized. Organization is what we need to be dealing with. Also this week it was a sister in California. Her and her family went to a grocery store, and they was trying to get items to prepare for this virus. And it was a racist person that worked at the store who claimed he was the supervisor, and he was, stopping their baskets, accusing them of stealing and all of this. And, the best way of battling or dealing with this situation was, recording the footage and uploading it onto social media to try to get support. I would urge us as Africans right now, if any time in society, here is the time to join a revolutionary political organization. You will not deal with you probably would deal with, but you will be better equipped to deal with a situation like this. Certainly in a time of crisis like we are in now, we've been in a time of crisis ever since we reached the shores of America, but right now we have a critical point as the masses of African people to politically equip ourselves. But that's all I want to present. That's my response to that question.
Okay, panelists, we only have a few minutes left. I want to read this point here, and I want you to respond to my next point that's coming. But I just want to add to a real interesting piece again in this article for our readers to read, to show that this actually happened. And this, you can go to Political. It said Political obtained documents from the meeting and spoke with more than a dozen attendees to help provide the most detailed reconstruction of the closed-door session. Now, as you said earlier, Brother Ike, they did things in secrecy. So this actually did took place, and they do have actual documents. So this is not even hypothetical. Given the fact we have stated that, one of the things I think that is looking like it may evolve and people is running fearful about it. It's this question of empowering the state to dominate and do as they please to the population at will in terms of control. Donald Trump has recently signed this Defense Production Act. And then they're talking about bringing National Guards and military maybe into the cities. What consequences you think may come from this particular decision if it occurs? And how do citizens respond to something of this nature in which they have never seen in this country? So how would you, Brother Anthony?
Yes. The solution, as was alluded to earlier, is permanent political organization. Let's see. The U.S. has a history of taking advantage of people's fear of the unknown, the consequences, in order to impose, greater political repression among the people. And this is a sign of that. And I think deploying the National Guard and the military will make conditions worse for the masses of the people. And I think there would be a greater degree of brutality than we've seen. Because of our disorganized state, so people need to be aware, be vigilant, and join an independent political organization, and because the existing duopoly, as the sister alluded to earlier, just furthers corruption and further disenfranchisement of the people. So
your response, Brother Hakeem?
Yeah, deploying troops to do absolutely nothing in terms of the fight against coronavirus. So clearly, the intent is not so much in terms of preventing the spread of coronavirus. It has more to do in terms of test run. I suspect that a lot of it has to do in terms of people's response to seeing the military out in force and getting people in a position where they're actually comfortable with military being in positions throughout the city. So I think it has political parameters, and I think that nobody should deceive themselves that what is happening is symptomatic of a larger strategy by the West in terms of maintaining absolute dominance and control. And I think this is important, particularly when you talk about the economy that's been in decline for the last 15 years, that this notion in terms of, maintaining control by all costs, I think is a prevailing theme in terms of the oppositions of power. And so therefore, force is the weapon of choice utilized by the West in terms of maintaining control. As far as what the people can do in terms of doing that, at the point that they actually do that, it's going to terminate. It's going to scare a lot of people. So I think it's going to take some time before people get their bearings and understand, that ultimately the only thing that's going to prevent the furthering of this kind of situation is a wholesale organization. So I think that it's going to take some time for people to actually come to the realization that you have that organization in terms of combating, the particular wrongs committed, by military troops, in these cities. So clearly I think that the orange man understands the political parameters and he's simply doing what he's told to do.
And your response, Maurice?
I'd probably be naive in thinking this, but if there are instructing people to keep crowds less than 10 at this point, why would they send in crowds more than 10 to dictate people staying in their homes? I don't know. I'm just thinking simplistically at this point. Like if they're telling us, keep crowds less than 10, stay in your homes and this and that. No crowds more than 20 or whatever the number is. Why are they sending large crowd. Why are they going to send large crowds of military forces into the region? And I know Brother Haki just answered that question because, you know, they testing this, they're starting it in California, and I believe they're starting this in New York, but it's kind of hypocritical to me. If you wanted to keep lower crowds, why would you bring in a military? I don't know. That's just my naive thinking, I guess.
Okay, panelists, relax for you. Relax for thanking all of you for giving you your provoking thoughts and analysis of some of the issues and ideas that we all need to be aware of the possibilities that may occur and to have a greater in-depth thinking in terms of what is taking place around this coronavirus issue. We'd like to remind our listening audience, please, when you get a chance, this article of interest titled Before Trump's Inauguration, A Warning, the Worst Influenza Pandemic Since 1918. Take a look at that and use that tool to learn from it and use the tool to help make humanity better. Until next time, we'd like to thank us. We'd like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to come to your home this evening and to share one aspect of the many missing pages of history. We'll see you next week, same time, same station. And let's remember, in order to move forward, we must understand what took place prior to our existence. In other words, we need to know our history. And once we know our history, it can serve as a guiding point, as a blueprint of moving our people and communities forward. Until next time, let's just continue to fill in those missing pages of history. We thank you for listening.